What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna mix in baby, me and you on my rocking bicycle that's built for two. Thanks for tuning in to Out There Today. It's Wednesday, February 14th. Oh, yeah, it's Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day. Today's show, I'm going to play something from the Beyond, which is an interview with my dad, Jim Woodring, talking about his five-year plan to become a certified as a better intervention in doing domestic violence counseling kind of work. And also I have a short clip from when I was in Kentucky last month doing a fundraiser called Shop and Share. It's a fundraiser, an annual fundraiser that they do in Kentucky for the domestic violence programs statewide. And so I have a little interview with a couple of guys that were volunteering, trying to work off their community service hours, getting donations in the store. And also I have an interview with Hema Priya. She's a researcher from UMass that was doing a research project over the last year, asking people who identified as Black and who identified as white about what they thought should be prioritized in the struggle for racial justice. So the second half of the show is an interview with her reporting the results of the study. And now, oh yeah, I don't know if I played this last week or not, but here's a little a one-minute quote from my travels in Knoxville. Here's a favorite quote. This is from the Tennessee Woman Suffrage Memorial in Market Square, downtown Knoxville, Tennessee. The statue of three women, Ann Dallas Dudley, Lizzie Crozier French, and Elizabeth Avery Meriwether. They lived between 1824 and 1955. But the quote from Abigail Scott Duniway says,
"The young women of today, free to study, to speak, to write, to choose their occupation, should remember that every inch of this freedom was bought for them at a great price. The debt that each generation owes to the past, it must pay to the future."
All right, now the next piece we have is my dad, Jim Woodring. We were actually in the car. He was driving me to catch the bus out of Knoxville, and he had asked me what my five-year plan was, if I had any kind of five-year plan. And I was kind of like, well, I'm pretty content with what I'm doing now. I kind of have my dream job with Pedal People, and I'm working on these other little projects like the radio show and like surge-related stuff, the bike lab, stuff like that. And I asked him, what's your five-year plan? And this is what he said. So what's your five-year plan, Joe?
My five-year plan is to become certified as a batterer intervention provider. And that's a category of helping or dealing with domestic violence. Most often it's dealing with males because it seems to assume that it's all physical because they have the term batter or batterer in it. But the worst domestic or the worst interpersonal violence is most often emotional, but you deal with them all, and it's the same thing now as probably anger management or domestic violence education or relationship counseling. All of that would happen, and it comes as an official program through the court system. This is, of course, this is court system of Kentucky. that when there is a protective order, an EPO, a merchant protective order, that goes on to a permanent domestic violence order, a DVO, the perpetrator, the bad person in the relationship, is often sent for batterer intervention meetings. And that's a 24-week program, 6 months. If it's people make their livings doing this, and not me, but in Bell County, Harlan County, the judges aren't going to send anybody to this program, no matter how bad they are, because so many of the batterers we see just don't have the kind of money that's charged to come. It's like $20 or $25 a session. I don't know what the current charges are. And so the judges just don't do it.
You mean they don't require it?
They don't send them.
They don't send them.
Because
who's gonna pay?
The people can't pay, even no matter how bad they are. And it's just, it doesn't help anything. But the lady I'm working with says that since it's official kind of counseling and therapy, insurance will pay for it. And I don't know what kind of insurance she's talking about, but the lady I work with, Cheryl, says it's probably your medical card will cover behavior therapy. And so I'll be working with this lady, but yeah, I don't care what she, how much we earn or don't earn. And most of it will be group.
But if you're getting the certification, because that will then allow you to accept insurance, is that the connection?
No, what do I want certification for?
Because you've been doing this work for quite a while without certification.
Yeah, yeah. It's like having a college degree. If you've been to college for 10 years and know everything, but never got a degree, lots of doors are closed to you. No matter how much you know and how talented, you know, the whole business. Because we're in many ways a meritocracy. Love big words. I got a college education. Okay. It's the same thing that it gives me, if I had this certification, freedom to pursue whatever might be out there in the future. The best example would be if I were certified in I can't even pronounce it. Anyway, that thing. There's good possibility I could go over to the forestry camp and
minimum
do programs.
Minimum security, state prison.
Yeah, the Bell County Forestry Camp, just down the road from our house. And that would be nice. You know, the commute would be a mile and a half.
Yeah.
I could walk over, ride Ruthie's bike. Yeah, it'd give me that kind of a opportunity to do other kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
What I need to be certified is what they call 1 hour a week face-to-face contact with my supervisor,
uh-huh,
which is Rhonda. And that could be, we just do a group together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that won't be any problem logistically to do. And then it's so many hours in practice for either time or for hours. And that's my current challenge, is to try to negotiate with the people in Frankfurt who are in charge of this program, to see how many hours I might count as already in.
Uh-huh.
And it's usually the equivalent of 2 years, like 400 hours or something.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know how many hours it is.
Like, how many years have you been doing domestic violence counseling intensely?
Probably 15, but I'd been doing it before that on a limited basis. So
yeah.
I've got about 15 years of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and if anyone wants an example of a client, they can check out your book. You want to get a little plug for your book, Always My Fault?
There you go.
That's Always My Fault by Jim Woodring.
Yeah, Amazon, it's on. It's published by Amazon, Create Space.
You want to say just briefly what it's about?
It was about a client I had who was abused, and frightfully abused, with threats on her life, attempts, I guess, to drown her once, and just lots and lots of emotional control, and she was how most victims of domestic violence are. Very confused and under control of the abuser, and she'd figure it out sometimes that she had to leave the guy, but it's very difficult for all kinds of reasons, and it took her 10 times, she left him 10 times before she stayed away and didn't go back to him. And even after she got the divorce and ended the relationship, he still kept after her.
Uh-huh.
But she finally figured out that she did not go back. And so that's her story. And it's, the name of the book is Always My Fault, because when there is domestic violence, it's a power and control issue. And it can be women controlling men, or men, women. Most visible is men, women, but...
Or same-sex couples, too.
Yeah, same-sex couples. Some people don't like to hear it, but experience and evidence, and even not with me... Well, yeah, once. Cheryl would see more of it. But he said, when they're she says when they're lesbians... They're more vicious than anybody else. And that's Cheryl's experience, and that's in the literature. Whatever the dynamics are. When it's violent, lesbians, and breaking up that relationship, it's bad. I know some people don't like to hear that, but that's how it works. But it's... I mean, this is domestic violence. What, I don't know what... it's bad, bad. It's violence against another person. No matter which way it's going. And it's a power and control issue. And the major way of control is keep control is, like the name of the book, they convince the victim that it's always their fault. It's always the victim's fault that he has to beat up on her and control her and do all kinds of bad things, because she, if it's a he, she makes him do it.
Uh-huh.
And how the dynamic works is she gets convinced, because he tells her all the time, you're not really doing this right, and you're a failure, and it's always your fault. And it's always your fault I have to treat you this way. And it's like a lot of things, if you hear it often enough, you begin to believe it. And once you begin to believe it, that you're then, just your self-esteem goes down, your guilt level goes up, and you look in the mirror or just think about it, and you begin to believe that maybe there is something wrong with me. And it gets reinforced, and well, maybe he is right. Maybe there is something wrong with me.
And then I'm sure you feel even worse about yourself, about not leaving and about not getting away from this person too.
Yeah, yeah. So initially, when most victims come to that kind of conclusion, it's not a well thought out conclusion, but it's how you feel about the whole business. The human response is, I'm just going to try harder to please him or to please the other person. And of course, the program is the other person is unpleasable.
Yeah.
There is no way, and that just reinforces the control that it is not going to happen. And that's how they keep control. Until it either gets so bad, or there's a something happens, or the perpetrator kills you, the victim, or that the victim gets so emotionally desperate that they kill the perpetrator, and then they go to jail for murder. Because they're the victim. Oh, it's often that's with a lot of women. That's the way it works. They've been beaten up and molested and stabbed and burned and who knows what, and they just snap and shoot or stab the guy and kill him, and then they're prosecuted for murder. I'm well, you know, they killed somebody, but they're yeah.
So you've been doing this work for like 15 years, you said, regularly, and your five-year plan is to get this certification to continue doing it. Does it ever feel like, I mean, like you see a lot of the worst sides of humanity? Does it ever feel like too much or depressing or
no,
just getting emotionally tiresome?
Not in the long run. Some days are worse than others. But the key to that is, I got a buddy. Cheryl and I cry on each other's shoulders.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it really, and Cheryl would say the same thing.
Uh-huh.
You just, if you really try and do this by yourself,
yeah,
it ain't gonna work. You just need, and we, you know, of course, we've both been sort of doing the same amount of time, but she's much more professionally trained, and a lot more involved in all the programs for victims of, and how the court system works and what all the legal ins and outs are. But yeah, we consult constantly, and that's one of the things on matters in intervention. There might be more of a, you talk about networking or support group. If you're in domestic violence, especially the way it's set up, as a court advocate for victims, physically, you're the advocate in the courtroom. And it's a Lone Ranger almost kind of stuff. People who have this kind of job, you got to be self-functioning. You do what you want. You aren't, you know, you're accountable to in our case, the shelter, the domestic violence shelter, which gets the grants and gets the funds and employs these people, but you're maybe answerable to the judge, but most of the time you're out there on your own.
Is that Cheryl Cottle? What's her official title?
Victims Advocate. A really official is Victims Advocate in Bell and Harlan County. The system in Kentucky of domestic violence shelters are organized into what are called ad districts. And in our case, that's 8 counties. And so each ad district, which is a governmental bureaucracy level, has one shelter.
One shelter for 8 counties?
That's it. We have one shelter of 30 beds for 8 counties.
Wow. Any idea what the population is of those 8 counties?
No.
300 and some thousand?
320,000.
Bottom line is, there's not very many beds.
Not many there, yeah.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That was an interview with my dad, Jim Woodring, who does domestic violence counseling in southeastern Kentucky. I have another clip I'm going to play in a couple minutes. It's from it's an interview with a couple of guys doing getting donations for the domestic violence shelters in Kentucky. But we're going to take a little break and play this song first, a little John Prine.
A new girl who was almost a lady. She had a way with all the men in her life. Every inch of her blossom and beauty. She was born on the 4th of July. Well, she lived in an aluminum house trailer. And she worked in a jukebox saloon. And she spent all the money that I give her just to see the old man in the moon. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise. Well, he'd go out on Saturday evenings to the driving on Route 41. And it was there that I first suspected that she was doing what she'd already done. She said, "Johnny, won't you get me some popcorn?" And she knew I had to walk pretty far. And as soon as I passed through the moonlight, she hopped into foreign sports car. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in a dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I well, you know, I could have beat up that fella, but it was her that had hopped into his car. And many times I fought to protect her, but this time she was going too far. Now, some folks, they call me a coward, 'cause I left her at the driving that night. But I'd rather have names thrown at me than to fight for a thing that ain't right. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I was a victim of the Great Compromise. Well, she writes all the fellas love letters, saying greetings, come and see me real soon. And they go and line up in the barroom
spend the night in that sick woman's dress. But sometimes I get awful lonesome, and I wish she was my girl instead. But she won't let me live with her, and she makes me live in my head. I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory, and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
That was John Prine. Welcome back to Out There. So the next clip is from Shop and Share, an annual fundraiser. I think Kentucky based. Started in Kentucky 3 or 4 years ago, I think. The governor's office sponsors it. And this was when was it? I think it was the first Saturday in February. And this is recorded from the Kroger's in Middlesboro, Kentucky. All right, so I'm here. David, your name's David, right?
Right.
David.
Yeah.
So what are you saying to people when they come into Kroger today?
I'm saying good day. They're having a Shop and Share, and it's for the domestic violence shelter for the surrounding counties. And if you could, anything on the list you can get, it'd be appreciated, and you could drop off right here on the corner.
What kind of reactions are you getting from people?
A lot of good. A lot of good. Yeah. So more good than bad.
Yeah.
So I see now there's a lot more good in the world than there are bad.
That's the spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we got like, I don't know, 25 boxes worth of stuff here that we collected today already.
Yeah.
Yes.
Doing really good.
What motivated you to come out here today?
I just did getting me some community service in. Just out dealing with the public and seeing what it's like. Yeah.
Have you done a sales pitch or like leafleting, flyering? I don't know what you call this work, like this door to door kind of stuff.
No, this is first time.
Cool.
It's first time for me. It's good for me because I'm kind of, I guess you'd say backwards anyway. I'm kind of backwards, a little shy, but I'm trying to come out of it. That's what brings you out of it. It's coming out and dealing with the public too. You know, it does.
Yeah, well, it's fun to watch you. You're doing like great, and I'm glad I get to sit back and sort stuff.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
My name is Rosé.
What are you doing out here today? It's at Kroger's.
Well, I'm basically doing some community service, trying to help people out for women and children. We're taking donations, food and canned goods. You know, I'm just trying to make it a better place.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, the way the Shop and Share works is people like David and Rosé and I were stationed at the entrances, and whenever someone came in, we would offer them a list of items that had been requested by the domestic violence programs and say, hey, if there's anything on this list that you can add to your shopping list today, that'd be really awesome. You can just drop it off in the shopping cart on your way out the door. And we were there from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and I'd say we got like 25 or 30 boxes worth of goods donated. It was really touching to see people's generosity. I was just looking online the other day about income levels. I lost the statistic, but the average household income in Bell County, Kentucky is about $21,000 compared to Hampshire County. It's like 60-some thousand dollars in Hampshire County. So it's just really touching to see people's generosity. I did also notice from like the consumer end of things, one of the favorite things that people ended up buying, and I don't know if this was because it was on sale at Kroger that day or what, but there was a lot of liquid hand soap that people bought. And I didn't grow up with liquid hand soap. It's, for me, I see it as very much this consumer product that just sort of came about in the last, I don't know, 10 or 20 years. Because I don't know why bar soap isn't good enough. I had a housemate once who said, I don't know, bar soap seems kind of skanky to me. I don't know about, like, you know, bacteria lingering on it or something. But studies show that bar soap is just fine. The bacteria doesn't live on it. You know, it doesn't affect you in any negative way. So go ahead and use that bar soap. You don't have the plastic packaging. And also, according to what I saw online, people tend to use way more liquid hand soap for washing than they do bar soap. I think like the cost per ounce is similar, or the cost per serving or whatever. I don't know if serving is the right word. But because of how much people tend to use, one study online that I found said that it ends up being like 10 times more expensive in some cases, the liquid hand soap. So, of course, the manufacturers like that. They can sell a bunch more of that. You're listening to Out There. I'm Ruthie Woodring. Now I'm going to share, since it's Valentine's Day, I'm going to share a little reading from my writing from my dad, which is called The Love Test. Will the real Saint Valentine stand up? He can't. There were three men named Valentinus who lived in Italy 1,500 years ago. They did good deeds and sacrificed their lives. 500 years later, the Roman Catholic Church declared one of them to be a saint. Which one? All three, because over the years, the stories and legends of each one got mixed together into one person, Saint Valentine. Since then, other myths, legends, and stories have grown up connecting St. Valentine with love. Originally, the love connection came because the saint loved God and others so much that he gave his life as a martyr. His greatest desire was to imitate a crucified Jesus. Between then and now, things have changed. Love as a sacrifice has changed to love as passion, infatuation, as romance, to following the cute god Cupid, rhymes with stupid, and his bow and arrow, as well as candy and roses. I don't mean this as a put-down of our modern Valentine's Day customs. I'm only giving an outline of its history. After all, what's wrong with celebrating love? Love comes in many forms and fashions. The giving and sharing of hearts and cards is one of the ways. It sure makes you feel better than having to deal with the daily news of death, drugs, and disasters. We can't underestimate the power of love, even the silly, frilly kind on Valentine's Day. The old song tells us, it's love that makes the world go round. It sometimes goes round too fast, and when it is that first love and you're head over heels on roller coaster emotions, or it can be as simple yet powerful as holding hands. Before I get carried away on Cupid's wings, I must speak of the downside of love. It has great power that people use to get their way by manipulating the one they say they love. Manipulation begins with the tiny word, if, and grows poisonous from there. If you love me, you will. You can fill in the rest of the sentence according to your experience. But here are some examples. Daddy, if you love me, you'll get me an ATV. Mommy, if you love me, you'll get me a Barbie doll. Honey, if you love me, you'll get me a diamond ring. Love doesn't send a loved one on a guilt trip to get your way. There's enough guilt in the world without using love to increase it. Since love covers such a great range of emotion, we sometimes wonder if we're loving enough. Is there any scale or way to figure out how loving we are or how much someone else loves us? The best way to decide that I know of comes from Jesus. Greater love has no one than this, that you lay down your life for a friend. Few of us ever expect to have such an opportunity or even plan on it. So our challenge is, how do we grow and increase the love we have? Here's how. If you love someone, you will be working for that person's well-being and welfare before your own. If someone loves you, they will be doing the same thing. It's a way to test your progress in growing into a more loving relationship. It's the love test. And that is my dad, Jim Woodring, his Valentine's Day writing. He writes for the local paper in the Pineville Sun in Pineville, Kentucky. You're listening to Out There here on Valley Free Radio. And I want to play this interview with Hema. I'm going to have to end up cutting it short at the end. But you know what? What I end up cutting short, maybe I can play some next week. I don't know. I just started and we'll see how it goes. Thanks for listening to Out There.
So my name is Hema Priya.
And how did you get involved in this research study?
So I'm a PhD student at UMass Amherst, and so we're encouraged to do a lot of research projects. So this is one of my projects. I'm trying to understand what are the different perspectives that people have on the role of white people in a movement for black lives. And so our participants are both white and black people who identify as racial justice activists or who have been involved in efforts to address racial issues around the Western Mass area. So some of them are students and some of them are community members.
So yeah, that's how we met, is because I saw a flyer for Hema's study and I replied to it, and I like the study experience so much. I was like, I just want to know what other people say and what the results are of the study. So when did you start interviewing people or having people do the sorting task over this? I don't know how you call the project.
Yeah, so the first task is a sorting task, and then there's a brief survey afterwards. When did we start? I feel it was more than a year ago.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It was like a year ago when I did it.
Yeah, so I think you were one of the first few participants to do it. It was more than a year ago, and I feel like the progress has been kind of slow. It was difficult to get participants at some point, and so it's also a pretty big commitment because we want people to come into the lab or meet us and then do this huge sorting task, and so sometimes it was difficult to get participants, and these are people who are involved in efforts, and so obviously that's more important to do things on the ground than to participate in a study. At least that was my perception, so I was always thinking, like, this is a favor that they're doing for us. So I guess it was more than a year ago, and then a few months ago is when we decided to stop data collection and start analyzing to try to understand, okay, so what are the perspectives that we are finding?
Uh-huh. Yeah. How many different people did you interview? Do you have a word that you would use?
I guess I would just call them participants. Yeah.
Okay. How many different participants did you get? And how did you get them? Where did you find them?
So flyers was one big thing. We tried to attend meetings. So we went to the Surge meeting, the Surge chapter in Western Mass, and tried to distribute flyers there to get people in, to let people know that we were doing this and we wanted to hear their perspectives. And so people contacted us through that, and also through the school, because there's a lot of activist groups on campus, so we tried to recruit through there as well. So participants could contact us. Yeah, so we kind of just put the word out there and then got people to contact us. So we in total got 33 white Americans and 22 black Americans. Mm-hmm. So we were only recruiting people who self-identified as white or black. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are other perspectives to include as well, but to start off so that we could specify the kind of groups that we want to... the groups that we want to target, so we specified black and white, because that seems to be the debate now, is like, so how do you get white people involved in a movement for black people? And so it seemed a good place to start before we move on to other Asian minority groups.
I want to take a minute to say, I think I mentioned this to you at one point, something about like the language of that, like a movement for black people. Mm-hmm. Because as a white person, identify as a white person, mm-hmm. Like the pain of racism is sometimes I think white people are numb to it. Mm. but it's also a movement to help white people be whole,
mm-hmm.
as well. But I think it's sort of like a linguistic
mm-hmm.
thing. I don't know if it's like a linguistic thing. Language affects how we think about things as
yeah.
well, too. But
so we're kind of labeling the movement or the effort as something already.
anyway, you have to do something, and you do the best you can. But I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah.
So the sorting task, when I did it, there's 60 cards. I just want to talk about, can you describe the task a little bit?
Yeah, so our first step is kind of just looking at a bunch of books and literatures and activist blogs to try to create statements that would reflect a variety of different roles that white people can take as allies to a movement for racial justice. And that's how we ended up coming up with 61 different statements. And so it was trying to be really all-encompassing, to be everything from learning to taking part in protests to interpersonal interaction. So we tried to be so this is a bunch of different things that white people can do. And so that's how we ended up with so many statements.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some of the specific cards, because I know there were some. If you have an example, that'd be great.
Our feet saved it. Oh, my God.
We dropped the computer. Because I know there were some cards. Mm-hmm. I would look at them, and I would look at the other one. I is this more important? Is that more important? And I would just go around and around in circles in my head.
Yeah, it was a difficult task for a lot of people.
It was very thought-provoking. I really, really appreciated that. It just made me think about my beliefs and why I think one thing is more important than another. And,
mm-hmm.
and it made me want to... It just made me really want to understand the issues better and
mm-hmm.
other people's perspectives, particularly black people's perspectives.
Because mm-hmm.
I found myself being I think this is more important, but know what
mm-hmm.
my black friends or allies think?
Yeah.
And of course, everyone's different, too.
Right. And one of the things that people told us during the data collection phase is that it's really hard to sort this because everything is important. And so we really force people to prioritize. So what is the top three that you think is the most important? And then slightly less important, slightly less. So, it was anchored on the most important to the least important. And so we really force people to prioritize these different things. So, these are some examples.
Okay. So here's some examples. learn about the history of whiteness and racism, or learn about what black people want from white people's involvement in the struggle for racial justice, or participate in classes and seminars and discussion groups to focus on racial issues, be aware of white privilege in different contexts, avoid taking up too much space during protests for racial justice, stand behind, physically stand behind black people during protests for racial justice.
Mm-hmm.
Always follow nonviolent strategies, even if black people do not. Avoid talking to people in the media during a protest, and instead direct media attention to black leadership. Intervene when witnessing racial prejudice or discrimination, for example, jokes, conversations, or actions. Boycott products or services that are racist. Vote for political candidates and support policies that advance racial justice. Sign online petitions. Anyway, so these things go on and on, the realms of friendship and interpersonal interaction
mm-hmm.
and personal education and political action.
Yeah, and some things are actions and some things are more avoiding things.
Uh-huh.
Some things are more inside you, trying to confront your personal biases,
uh-huh.
and some things are really about intervening or calling things out. So we try
uh-huh.
to be as encompassing as possible.
Uh-huh.
And on the survey that participants filled out after the sorting task, we always asked, so is there anything more to add?
Uh-huh.
And most people said, nope, it was pretty... I can't think of anything else yet.
That's
good, yeah.
Uh-huh. What was one of your favorite things about doing this task with participants?
So, although people struggled to sort it, I really enjoyed hearing the feedback. as they read through each statement, because we really encourage people to talk about it, you know, as they're sorting, what's the thought process like. And so I really enjoyed doing that. Some of the studies that we've done for research, we don't even get to see the participants because they are sometimes online participants. So we just put the survey out there, complete it, and then we get the data back. And it's so impersonal. And that can be good for some reasons, but for a study like this, I really appreciated hearing people's feedback about it. It was really humbling. And yeah, and I think gave me a chance to get to know the participants like you. Yeah.
Were there any surprises for you, or wait, do you have a collaborator?
Yeah, so my collaborator is Melis, and she is an expert on this type of sorting task, and the research method is specifically called Q methodology, and so she's an expert on Q methodology, which involves coming up with a bunch of statements and then getting participants to sort them. So this idea of trying to get a holistic representation of various perspectives on anything. So you can kind of adopt this methodology to study different perspectives about current social issues, and then you pick specific issues to study. So she really helped me develop this project.
Mm-hmm. So were there any surprises for either of you?
I would say a surprise is really the variability in how participants approach the task. So some participants completed it in like 20 minutes. So they were super fast and they were like, yep, I'm very clear about my view of these things. And then some participants really struggled and took up to an hour or more.
Yeah, I think it was on the hour end.
So that was interesting to me, like the thought process of participants and maybe additional constraints. So maybe the people who sorted really fast, maybe they just had another class to go to or something else to do that we didn't maybe get them at the right time, or they were really clear about their view. So sometimes it's still difficult to understand people's thought process, even though this was more intimate than other studies. Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, the hour that I spent sorting and stuff, I mean, that was an educational process in itself. Like, I learned things as I went along, which would then maybe make me want to shuffle the order I'd put something in.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be a fun task, and sometimes when we get participants who are students from the student pool, I think they also vary in how much they identify as an activist and how interested they are in something like this. So maybe that's another factor or another confound that could influence our results. Yeah.
So did you find any pattern of different results from people in different categories? Did you have any other categories besides black and white?
No, we did not.
Okay.
Yeah, and another surprising thing, I guess, is that we got almost all women. I think there were only three men in our participant pool. So I'm not sure if that is representative of activists in this area. But yeah, most of our participants were female. And we didn't find differences based on whether participants were black or white in trying to identify the different perspectives. So it seems like each perspective that we saw, there were both black and white participants who endorsed it to a degree. So that was also surprising to me. But as I talked about it more with Melis, my collaborator on this project, we thought, you know, maybe this is a sampling thing. Maybe in our specific community, we can find people who endorse these different views. And since the different roles that we were investigating were all pretty positive, like none of the roles are explicitly negative or that would harm a movement, maybe. So that's why people in general agreed with it on both sides. So maybe they're not there's no conflict or debate there. Yeah.
Can you share some of the results, I guess, that you sort of, the categorizing?
Sure. So the way this data is analyzed, we try to extract factors or narratives that are unique. So definitely the factors that we extract is not going to be representative of all the, like, everyone who identifies as an activist. So this is based on the sample that we had access to.
I'm going to cut out in that interview now. You can tune in next week to Out There. I'll try and play the other half of it. There's actually another 12 minutes. And that was an interview with Hema Preya, a researcher from UMass. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I want to announce tomorrow's City Hall meeting, Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. The Northampton City Council will vote on a resolution to support immigrants and people with temporary protected status, TPS. We need your presence and testimonies of support. And invite your friends. That's tomorrow's City Council meeting. Also, I want to highly recommend the Coming Together website. It's coming-together.org out of Amherst. Here's one of their pages that says, "What can we do? Four key actions for everyone. Actions for racial justice. Keep learning, connect with others, tell your stories, feel and heal." And there's some really specific things on this website, including learning two statistics that, like, as a white person, that you can use to connect with other white people to help other white people get a sense of how real racism is today. What else was I going to say? Oh, yeah. It's February, but it's a great time to ride a bike.
It makes me feel free.
Wait, let me try that again.
It makes me feel free.
I do it to save money.
I feel in charge when I'm doing it.
It's a healthy way of life.
Why do you bicycle instead of driving a car?
It's a good way to fit more exercise into my day.
Bicycling is a fun, healthy, economical, and fuel-efficient way to travel. Enjoy the ride. Take your bike. Brought to you by the Franklin Regional Council of Governments and Pioneer Valley Planning Commission, with funding provided by the Federal Highway Administration and Massachusetts Executive Office of Transportation. Come visit enjoytherideby-bike.com.
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Vengan al Bike Lab de Northampton, el taller de bicicleta. Aprende a arreglar tu bicicleta y a divertirte.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue. They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. This is Bideo Bubes with My Feeling.
Song of motherland, book me nang mafeel, better you understand. Bo xama tul fa la jame, tel lul fa ma jige bom, yande ko du sel, ci zanu sere. Ala la li ayo le, yera jari kolle. My culture, mi ngi ne tege dal fu mu tegu won ki je suis ki je fais ki je viens war nga ko xam ki sont les miens ou sont tes tiens tes africains ou bien rien lu ci sa ala fuy sa scan xarit sama war nga xam 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 ji la ku won de la sama nga tegu ci yoon mo sangay lañu ñu sangé jarama isu du bubuli panel bubu mam boy lu mu jobo na ngay law ba ni jarama sal eliman ay se po dor ni men right xana fu ñu jëm de na ay jëm jëm
Yeah.
daldi ak soweto pilingi ci musique be ma dagane ñu jaxaso grosso modo tempo tempo ci bañi dor lañu newon lañu jital ak de mieux am ñu ngi ci gis luñu bëgg under under yek dank dank feel da music original music melting pot le retour à zéro.
This is Dwayne, the dog. Rennie, tune in every Friday from 2 to 4 for My Generation. Rock with me through the 70s once again. Only on WXOJ 103.3 in Northampton.
Table of Contents is a weekly music program that assembles an assortment of songs and sounds of many genres, and which may entail literally taking a random collection of musical sources off the shelf and giving them a turn on the table or spin in the CD or tape player. Each week presenting shows which can at times be organized orderly and at other times perhaps be not as much so, yet never dull. Tune in Friday nights 10 p.m. till midnight on WXOJ LP Northampton 103.3 FM.